from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark in for Lester Graham. On today's show, the opioid epidemic. A Michigan lawsuit wants drug manufacturers and distributors to pay for the costs of addiction on society.
They are at the center of what we believe to be the deadliest and most costly drug epidemic in American history.
A decade after spending millions and millions of dollars on child protective services, a new investigation finds more children in Michigan are dying from abuse and neglect.
Laws and policies that are meant to protect kids just aren't being followed.
Plus, we'll have a look at the week in politics. Hello, election 2018. And we have a new artisan of Michigan. Those stories and much more today on Stateside. But first, this news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, sitting in today for Lester Graham. Coming up, we are going to ask who is protecting Michigan's foster kids. A new report from the Lansing State Journal found that more children under the state supervision are dying from abuse or neglect than a decade ago. But first, the prescription opioid drug addiction problem not only takes its tolls, of course, in lives and families, but it also costs local governments in different ways, like emergency medical services and more police work. Some municipalities are now signing on to a lawsuit against manufacturers and distributors of prescription painkillers. One of the attorneys filing a lawsuit is Mark Bernstein. He spoke with host Lester Graham earlier in the week.
First, tell us a little bit more about the costs these cities and these other local governments are facing because of opioid addiction.
Well, first, Lester, thanks for having me. I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to talk about this. The costs are estimated by the National Council of Economic Advisors in a brief filed with the court in this litigation as being about $504 billion a year, 2.7% of the GDP of this country. 25% of those costs are estimated to fall on the public sector, primarily municipalities, counties, and cities, and in some instances, states involving Medicaid expenses. So that's the scale of this. It's an enormous economic burden. It's also obviously has profound societal consequences, as we know. But the size of this, the economic cost, the taxpayer money that's been spent to clean up this mess is enormous.
Who are you suing?
So the defendants in our claim are the opioid manufacturers and opioid distribution companies. They are at the center of what we believe to be the deadliest and most costly drug epidemic in American history.
So in what ways are these companies are responsible, as you allege, for these costs to municipalities?
So these companies have been involved in what we believe to be, and not just us, but the DEA, the FDA, and others, along with 41 other attorneys general, involved in misrepresenting, diverting, and promoting the misuse of these drugs. These are highly addictive drugs. It's important to note that this is not a typical pharmaceutical mass tort litigation where you allege that a particular drug was manufactured incorrectly or didn't do what it was supposed to do. In this particular case, these drugs are doing exactly what they are designed to do. And in many instances, or in very narrow instances, I should say, they're invaluable drugs for people who are suffering pain. They are perfect and necessary in certain oncological applications or in certain post-surgical circumstances, or in palliative care, where addiction is not as big of a concern as pain management. But they were never supposed to be prescribed for root canals or soft tissue back injuries. And they certainly, given the addictive qualities of these drugs, should have never been prescribed in the volume. So 13%, as an example, of people who take an opioid are still taking that, if they take it for 8 straight days, 13% of those people are still taking it 1 year later.
So let's back up a little bit, because Sure. You're saying it's the manufacturers, it's the distributors, but there are a lot of what they call intervening players. There are doctors and dentists. There are people who, pharmacists who might know this customer is, getting this prescription again and again and again. So how do you sort out who's really responsible in this situation?
That's an important and fair question. We believe that this problem began with, and the responsibility in many respects ends with, the pharmaceutical manufacturers and distributors, that they misrepresented in astonishing ways the addictive qualities of these drugs to these very responsible parties, physicians, dentists, health systems, medical providers, et cetera. As an example, in 2003, three senior executives at Purdue Pharmaceuticals, a private company, paid $600 million in fines to the government for a marketing effort that relied on misrepresentation of the addictive qualities of these drugs. These pharmaceutical companies, in this particular instance, essentially said these aren't addictive. In some instances, they went so far as to say that if a patient that you did a particular procedure on isn't complaining about pain, they are actually in more pain than they're telling you, and you should prescribe more opioids. Insys, a company that was profiled just yesterday in the New York Times, had extraordinary marketing efforts that pushed these drugs into the marketplace. This is not soap or a consumer product that's being sold. It's a highly regulated, highly addictive product that was being pushed into patients' hands through a concerted effort of misrepresentation regarding the addictive qualities of this. So you had this, the minimization of the addictive quality of the drug by in the sales effort. And at the same time, you had this pushing of the of these products into the marketplace through these prescribers. You know, the state of Michigan has 1.2 opioid prescriptions for every man, woman, and child in the state of Michigan. In some counties, it's even higher. In Genesee County, it's 1.5 opioid prescriptions per citizen in that county. That's men, women, and children of all ages. Macomb County, it's 1.2. These companies see this, the distribution and the volume of opioids flowing out of their warehouses, in the case of the distributors, and they have a responsibility to ask questions that they never asked.
Let's get down to what kind of compensation these municipalities could see if the companies settle. It seems to me that's a formula that's a little difficult to deal with.
So there are two, our lawsuit, which, and we represent right now over 50 municipalities. Roughly 5.1 million citizens in the state are represented through these municipalities in this litigation.
So that's half the population.
A little bit over half the population in the state. In this particular case, the, what these municipalities are demanding are really two categories of relief. The first is injunctive relief. It's demanding that the court force a different course of or type of a behavior by these defendants to stop the diversion, misrepresentation, and activities that we believe have driven this. And that's an enormously important element of the case. The second case, which you allude to, is the economic damage. The economic damage falls into really two categories, and this is taxpayer money or working to reclaim taxpayer money that's been spent to deal with this mess. Everything from paying for naloxone or Narcan doses, which sheriffs and police departments now have to use in astonishing ways and in different high volume.
Yeah, for those of us who aren't familiar with that, tell us what those are.
So Narcan is a drug that is an antidote to an overdose. And so sheriffs, for example, in Macomb County are administering this drug Narcan. It's between $600 and $1,000 per dose. At almost every auto accident, for example, that involves somebody that is unconscious, the frequency of opioid addiction and its relationship to those types of accidents is so high that they're going through this drug like water, and it's enormously
expensive. And they're making
expensive.
That assumption that...
They're making that assumption. And here's an interesting aside. The level of addiction is so high that now they oftentimes have to administer two or three Narcan doses to the same person to reverse the impact of their opioid use. So that's a cost, but it's in many respects, that's a relatively minor one. It's addiction services, it's drug courts, it's jail and incarceration fees, it's addiction services for inmates in jails where counties, for example, don't get reimbursed for any of the medical care they provide an inmate in their jail, for example. And it's also, for example, medical examiner costs. In Ingham County, one of our clients, for example, they have a roughly $250,000 contract with Sparrow Health System for medical examiner costs. Halfway through the year last year, they had blown through that $250,000 primarily because of autopsies related to opioid overdoses.
So everything you've told me so far supports this idea that this opioid epidemic is not going to be going away anytime soon. In the long run, these local governments will continue to see extra costs because of it.
Yeah.
So what's the strategy so that this doesn't amount to a one-shot moment that they get a little money in this lawsuit, but they don't take future costs into consideration?
Well, that's an important question. We believe when municipalities consider this circumstance, that they should ask themselves, what should we be doing about this opioid crisis? And our answer to them is they should be doing, we believe, everything possible. They should be using the criminal justice system to shut down pill mills. They should be using the regulatory environment to curb this conduct. They should be seeking legislative relief in Lansing and in Washington to address this. And they should also be using the civil justice system to hold these defendants, these bad actors, accountable. Ultimately, the cost of this in many respects falls on taxpayers for responsibilities that municipalities cannot avoid and which they are paying dearly for. We believe that we have already seen changes as a result of this lawsuit. So, for example, Purdue Pharma has already stopped. This was announced about 2 months ago.
This is the maker of Oxycontin.
This is one of the manufacturers. Yeah. Yes, exactly. They have announced that they're no longer doing direct sales activity related to opioids. That is an enormously significant change. But the cost of this epidemic will be with us for many, many years.
I saw an MLI story which indicated some Kalamazoo County leaders are discouraging their local governments from getting involved in a lawsuit, the lawsuit you filed against manufacturers and these large pharmacy companies. They think it's a slippery slope that might damage the municipality's economic well-being in the long run because, you know, the idea is companies like Pfizer, which is really important in Kalamazoo County, might not want to do business in a community that's suing its industry. How valid are their concerns?
You know, they're entitled to their concerns. And Kalamazoo County, I believe, voted to proceed with an exploration of this litigation. First of all, Pfizer is not a defendant in this claim. There are no Michigan-based defendants in this claim. So that argument, I don't think, frankly, is persuasive. Additionally, there are many municipalities and states that have pursued claims against, many of the defendants that are listed in our case, that have significant operations in their counties related to these very defendants. At the end of the day, I think this is about leadership and courage. I think this is about holding these companies accountable for the mess that they've created. And I think it's about honoring the fiduciary duty of municipal leadership to get taxpayer money back.
Some of these county leaders have suggested, hey, this is something the U.S. Justice Department should be doing, not through civil lawsuits in the federal courts.
Right. Well, so the U.S. justice system, Attorney General Jeff Sessions, has filed what's called a Statement of Interest of the United States of America in this litigation already. It does not support the litigation, but they are a part of this litigation. So they are watching this very closely. They are not in opposition to it. Again, 41 attorneys general across the country, both Democrats and Republicans, have engaged in this litigation because they understand the need for it.
Mark Bernstein is among the attorneys filing federal civil lawsuits on the behalf of local governments in Michigan seeking damages for costs related to opioid addiction. Thanks for coming in and explaining this to us.
Lester, thank you. I'm grateful to you and to your listeners for listening to me.
Stay with us. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, sitting in for Lester Graham today. And we're visiting some of our favorite conversations, like the one you're about to hear. In his book, Black Detroit, author Herb Boyd takes a comprehensive look at the contributions, accomplishments, and long suffering of the African Americans who've called Detroit home. Boyd spoke with Lester last summer.
You cover abolitionists, soldiers, merchants, leaders, black nationalists, the list goes on. Let's start at the beginning, though. Since it's a northern city, not everyone realizes that early Detroit included a lot of slaves, some of them Native Americans, some of them African Americans. How common was slavery in Detroit?
Well, one of the things about this, and a number of books kind of misconstrued the whole question or issue of slavery. In the so-called Northwest, the Northwest Ordinance of 1787, which, of course, outlawed slavery in the territory. But, of course, you always have a difference between what they call de jure and de facto.
Right.
It was a whole lot of slave holders here in the city of Detroit. During this research, Lester, I thought I had Detroit's history pretty cold, particularly from a black perspective. How wrong I was. And of course, the whole slavery issue, looking at the abolitionist period, it was just so fruitful in terms of getting an understanding of the very beginning of African people, African-American people in the city.
Well, let's talk about that because, I mean, with its proximity to Canada, Detroit was the last stop on the Underground Railroad. What role did the Detroit black community play in abolitionism?
One of the individuals that I focus on here is William Lambert, along with George D. Baptiste. They were pretty much the pioneers. They were the chief conductors of the Underground Railroad. Detroit is like the terminus. You can make it to Detroit, you figure that you have a refuge, a sanctuary, and you escape bondage, but you, the bounty hunters were always on the trail. And I talk about the Blackburn affair. This is Thornton and Lucy Blackburn, who arrived in Detroit in the 1830s from Louisville, Kentucky. And
escaped.
Yeah, exactly. They're fugitives, and they arrive here after they're abducted or grabbed off by these bounty hunters. And the Detroit residents, you know, at that time say, no way in the world we're going to let you keep them and take them back into bondage. And so therein ensues, you know, a lot of conflict. Ultimately, they get across the Detroit River, they get off to Windsor, and ultimately end up in Toronto, Canada, many, many years later.
But there are racial problems after that because
Doubt. I mean, because, see, a sheriff is killed as a result of this. So that means there's the trials and the outrage in the community. So this is really Detroit's first riot in 1833.
Let's jump ahead a few decades to the Civil War. A lot of European immigrants were angry about conscription into the military service. What was their attitude and how did that affect African Americans in Detroit?
Mostly hostility between the African-American community and the Irish community. Usually when you have those issues is around housing and jobs. And of course, jobs is critical in this situation because many of the white workers figured that, why should I be going off and losing my job? As soon as I leave my job, a black person come in and take it. So there was some concern, some discontent about the whole involvement, you know, of white workers, you know, in this here war that creates some tension in the community.
There was already tension because these were fairly new immigrants, a lot of them, and they're being conscripted to fight in a war to help free black people while they watched a black person take their job when they leave. So that adds to that whole tension.
It adds to the conflict, no doubt.
Let's go to the 20th century. Detroit became a city of opportunity for a lot of workers. Work was referred to in one song as going to work at Mr. Ford's place. It was attractive. Tell us about that migration from the South to Detroit.
This is the first, the so-called Great Migration of the 1920s, and it was spurred by an offer coming from Henry Ford, $5 a day. Can you imagine that? It was an astronomical amount of money at that time, particularly for sharecroppers, people so recently emancipated from slavery. So you had this huge influx, you know, coming from Mississippi, Georgia, and particularly from Alabama. These sharecroppers down south, the black sharecroppers, seeing this possibility to get beyond the cotton curtain to get to the so-called promised land. And so this offer spurred a whole lot of activity in this country and gave Detroit this year kind of quadrupled the black population in the city of Detroit. But it created what you call social welfare problems, too, in terms of housing and the so-called jobs that was offered. Some of that was illusion.
Mm-hmm. Right. And then we saw further migration during World War II, both black and whites from the South. With that migration, Southern attitudes were further carried into the city. That brings us to 1943. Mm. There was a race riot. What sparked that?
Well, one of the things, now we have like a very strong black population in the city, and many of them come as a result of the second migration. My mother was a part of that one, 1941-43, when she arrived in the city. I arrived in Detroit a couple of months before the 43 riot. That was kind of like my introduction to Detroit, more or less, when I was 4 years of age. There was a certain kind of a bubbling tension and intensity in the community between the various groups anyway, which you might call the ingredients for an explosion there. All you needed was a fuse and then the spark. And a rumor sparked that, and next thing you know, boom, 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 the two communities are at each other's throats. We lost quite a few people, you know, at that time. The housing, the property damage, you know, was very extensive. That's the kind of like the follow-up. You're looking at 1833, 1863, now you got the 1943, and you have some of the same problems, you know, that created this turmoil.
Well, the city's had these race-based clashes every generation or so. It's also been a city of opportunity for black citizens. They might not have been able to get the job that they'd hoped for when they got here, but that caused them to create their own businesses, and a lot of them became very successful. So who stands out to you in that?
That's a story I try to tell in there that's not often told in terms of the black elite, the black entrepreneurs, the black middle class, because ultimately that's going to be the mother's milk, you know, of the city of Detroit in terms of stabilizing and the foundation. You got these African-American, the aspirations, you know, the ingenuity, the genius, you know, the even like an Elijah McCoy, you know, in terms of the innovations and the inventors coming in that would add to this here kind of industrialization that's taking place in the city of Detroit. So black workers are at the point of production, but at the same time, they're connected to these black entrepreneurs. In fact, the restricted covenants at that time, you know, Lester, kept us confined in such a ways that you could have like the young man who was running a shoeshine parlor is living right next door to a lawyer and to a doctor. So they're kind of like this here mutual sharing, you know, in terms of their conditions, both the white supremacy, the racism, the segregation. In other words, there was some kind of benefits coming from segregation in terms of these various classes being melded together like that.
How did you deal with the 1967 uprising in your book, Black Detroit?
You have to put it in historical and political context. It's not in a vacuum. It's like 1943, there were some precursors, things that led up to it. We had similar circumstances in 1967, the whole Kershaval situation on the east side in 1966.
Remind us what that was.
Exactly. The Northern School, Eastern High School, the walkouts of young people who were concerned about the education in the city. So you had the educational problems, you had housing problems, and you certainly had employment situation, to say nothing of police brutality. So you mix all those things together, you know, you have a recipe for disaster, and that's essentially what happened with 67.
The arts, culture, and activism of African Americans in Detroit is important in your book. Often they intermingle. You had a firsthand look at a lot of that part of Detroit. How did you decide what to put into the book?
Oh, Lester, what a decision that is, because you have so much to choose from. Of course, when people talk about Detroit, the first two things out of their mouths and their understanding is Motown, and after that is the automobile industry. But of course, what you discover in Black Detroit that is much deeper than that. At one time in the 1960s, Lester, you could not talk about a quartet, a quintet, a trio, or ensemble, or orchestra, or big band that did not have an African-American musician in it. But that goes back to the 1880s, 1890s, Theodore Sweeney, and we going right on down to McKinney's Cotton Pickers in the 1920s, to say nothing of this here real explosion in the 1960s, both on rock and roll, rhythm and blues, John Lee Hooker. Detroit had that reputation. And of course, that was a long-standing reputation that continues even today.
I want to ask you about what's being called Detroit's latest renaissance. The politicians and promoters like to call it the comeback city, but in many of the neighborhoods where I spend the bulk of my time reporting, the recovery is not really having much of an impact. Based on what you learned writing this book, what do you think the trajectory of the city and its residents is?
For me, whenever I look at a city or even a civilization, my first concern is the treatment, the condition of the children, condition of the women. What we see here in Detroit is like almost like a tale of two cities. And the whole question of gentrification, I don't know how much that is a concern here in Detroit, because
it's becoming a greater one.
It's becoming a more and more of a concern. But one of the things about this is that the kind of concentration of capital and the concentration of investment and housing and building, it has to be a little bit more extensive than just downtown Midtown. And until it reaches out into the 138 square miles of the city of Detroit, where it begins to impact some of the neighborhoods that I grew up in, I can see where there's like either vast empty lots or dilapidated buildings. These are kind of ongoing concerns that many of the neighborhoods have. And so I would love to see a little bit more of emphasis and impetus. You know, it seemed to be flourishing downtown. I mean, it gives you kind of the illusion that Detroit is doing quite well. We had that kind of illusion in 1967, didn't we?
Herb Boyd is the author of Black Detroit, A People's History of Self-Determination. He's a son of Detroit who currently teaches African-American history and culture at the City College of New York in Harlem, where he lives. Thanks very much.
Always, Lester. Thank you.
Thank you.
Lester Graham has been traveling this state to find people who make useful things with their hands. And this time, his stop is out in the country near Rockford, Michigan.
My name is Henry Cheddar. I make brooms, all kinds, different sizes, styles, colors. I like to use recycled materials, branches, golf clubs, old harnesses, lots of different things. I put my brooms on.
How'd you get started?
Well, when I was 8 years old, my dad told me, Henry, 1 second after school, I want you in a broom shop. Well, he did that for a reason, because I was a mischief maker, all the time getting into mischief. And if he kept his eye on me, I couldn't get into mischief. And to this day, it still keeps me out of mischief.
How did he get involved in making brooms?
His father made brooms too.
So you're third generation broom maker?
Correct.
And he's been making brooms for more than 60 years. Now, I know a person who makes shoes is called a cobbler, and a person who makes wood barrels is a cooper. But what's a broom maker called? Well, a broom squire, which I kind of like a lot. Cheddar has a few newer machines in his shop, but mostly he uses antiques, a de-seeder, a stitching press or vise, and a broom winder, which he's starting to use to make a broom.
I use my foot-powered machine.
How old are these machines?
Some of them are from stitching vise is from the late 1800s. My machine over there would be from the early 1900s.
That you're still making brooms in that day?
Oh, yeah. Not a thing wrong with that machine. Matter of fact, that machine I got from a blind man. A blind man made his living making brooms with that machine. So I figured if a blind man can make brooms, I should be able to make brooms.
Cheddar says he does have an electric broom winder, but he doesn't use it that much. The foot-powered broom winder gives him a lot more control. He does everything right on the property. He even raises the broom corn used to make the brooms.
It's kind of like magic. I start with a seed and I wind up with a broom. I plant the broom corn by hand. I start picking around August and I will pick till the snow flies on 2.5 acres. It does not all ripen at the same time.
What does that plant look like?
It looks like sweet corn, like corn, except there's no ears. And where the tassel on a corn would be, that's where the broom corn grows. And after I pick it, I take the seeds off, and then I let it cure for 3 months, and then in early January, February, I start making brooms with last year's crop.
It looks like there's a different process for a lot of different kinds of brooms. Give me the general idea about what you do.
First, I sort the broom corn by what length broom I can get out of it. And then the first thing I do before I make a broom is get it wet. Otherwise, when I twist it around, the wire would cut it and it would break. And when I twist it around, it would break. If it's moist, it's very durable. But if it's dry, it'll break easily. That's how come every broom that I make, every broom that I sell, I tell the people to keep it moist. Moist it 3-4 times a year. Just run a garden hose over it, and that's all you need to do. And once it's moist, it's very durable.
He says treat a natural broom well, and it'll last a long time. All his brooms are made to be used, but some of them are so ornate, you just know they're going to end up hanging on somebody's wall.
If people use them for decorations, that's fine. Just so they don't abuse them and come back and tell me that they fell apart or something. I've only had 2 brooms come back. One lady, she asked me how long shall this broom last, and I told them 5-6 years at the very least. And she brought it back to me. 6 years later, she told me, Henry, your broom that you made for me told me it's going to last 6, 7, 8 years. It's all wore out. So I told her, lady, I'd like to see the broom, and she brought it back. It was wore down all the way to the stitching strings. I asked her, lady, what'd you do with that broom? Looks like she took a knife and just cut it off. She told me she sweeps the sidewalk and the street, both sides of the street, in the morning and in the evening, every day. On the concrete... Concrete is very hard on a broom, and I told her, lady, I sold this as a house broom, but you're losing out, which is fine. I gave her another broom. You can't argue with a customer. And then another guy brought a broom back. Henry said, your handle broke. He said, what'd you do? He said, I was just sweeping it, and the handle broke. Well, a little girl about 8 years old spoke up. She said, Dad, you had a cat with it.
Well, he did, no broom for him just for being mean to the cat, right?
As Cheddar kept winding the wire tight around the broom handle, strategically placing the broom corn, he noted that his father made the same standard brooms over and over again. He's used just about everything you can think of for a broom handle. Clarinets and trombones, gun stocks and deer hooves, rolling pins, and then some of the broom handles are simply the broom corn braided or braided up the shaft of a handle, just like the broom he wanted to show me.
This one is a broom I sent in to be judged to Arcola, Illinois. Every year, a bunch of broom makers send a broom in who see who can make the fanciest or the latest style broom. And 2015, I sent this broom in, and I won first prize, $500, with this broom.
So, a nationally recognized broom squire. That's Henry Cheddar with Brooms by Henry.
Making a broom is messy, so I make a perfect tool to clean it up.
He's our latest artisan of Michigan.
And we found this artisan via the Michigan Traditional Arts Program of the Michigan State University Museum. Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. And coming up in about 10 minutes, we're going to check in with Ken Sikkema and Vicki Barnett. We are going to take a look at the week's news. We will look into all of the crazy gubernatorial politics happening right now in election 2018. You're listening to Stateside right here from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark in for Lester Graham. The Lansing State Journal has a new report out this week. It found that more Michigan kids are dying from abuse or neglect a decade after a federal lawsuit first forced the state to spend millions of dollars more on improvements. Joining us now is LSJ's government reporter, Justin Hinckley. He joins us from the LSJ newsroom. Hey there, Justin.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. So take us back to 2008. What was going on with protective services in Michigan that prompted all of this oversight in the beginning?
Sure. So it actually predates that. Going all the way back to 2000, there were a number of stories, reports by newspapers about government failures in several child deaths. In 2005, here in the Lansing region, we had Ricky Holland, who was killed by his adoptive parents. And when reporters and oversight agencies looked into it, they just found all of these mistakes that were being made by the state's child welfare employees. And so in 2006, Children's Rights, which is this act, this group out of New York, filed a lawsuit in federal court, and that was settled in 2008. And as part of that settlement, the state agreed to make a number of reforms and hold itself accountable to a number of metrics regarding caseloads for employees, timeliness of getting kids into safe permanent homes, and a lot of other things within that. And so for the past 10 years, the federal court, Children's Rights, have been monitoring the state's progress as they go through these reforms.
Okay, so increased child welfare budget, increasing the child welfare staff, but here we are 10 years later, and you found some startling numbers.
Yeah, essentially, if you dig into, there's a lot of oversight agencies on the state's child welfare agency. The Children's Ombudsman, for example, looks into complaints about CPS, foster care, adoption, and they investigate all child deaths if they happen in foster care or shortly after some other sort of intervention by child welfare. And they are finding a lot of the very same mistakes that reporters were talking about before the lawsuit was even filed. Laws and policies that are meant to protect kids just aren't being followed. They're not doing the right kinds of interviews in these CPS investigations and end up making the wrong decisions, and that's leaving kids at risk.
So in 2008, the year Michigan settled the lawsuit, the state reported 59 deaths from abuse or neglect. In 2016, that's the most recent year data was available that you found, Michigan reported 85 such deaths and became one of the five worst states in the nation.
Yeah. In 2016, the most recent data we have available, that's 85 deaths from abuse and neglect. That same year, the ombudsman opened a record number of investigations into deaths that happened, as I mentioned, either in foster care or after recent state intervention.
And part of your piece, I mean, you actually talk on record with folks who used to work or working with the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services. What did they tell you? What are some of the stories that you heard?
I think there's a lot of frustration in the workforce. A lot more people have told me things than were quoted in this and other stories I've worked on, but essentially that they get the feeling that their bosses' bosses, are more focused on escaping the court oversight, which is costing the state a lot of money. They've spent $25 million in the last 10 years just on legal fees and court monitoring costs. So there's this feeling among the workers that they are their bosses are more interested in these metrics that are part of this lawsuit than on doing the things that kids and families really need, and that workers who feel like they're putting in the time trying to do what's best for kids are not given the flexibility to do that. And if they end up missing any of these deadlines or things that are spelled out in the lawsuit, that they get harassed and bullied, and it's just a bad work environment. So a lot of people quit, move on to escape that environment, and so that means that the department just has a real issue with turnover and a lot of young, relatively inexperienced workers. And, you know, the policy book in DHHS is inches thick, and so when you've got someone without a lot of time on the job trying to work through that, that's where you're going to end up with a lot of mistakes, according to a lot of the workers that I talk to.
And then it's these foster kids who are, you know, living the consequences of all of
yeah.
that. What did the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services tell you about you know, sort of their view, their side of things?
Sure. So citing the ongoing lawsuit, there's a status hearing in Detroit next week. They wouldn't sit down for an interview with me. I sent them dozens of written questions, telling them what I found, asking them to, you know, tell me what was going on. And they didn't answer any of those written questions specifically. Instead, they offered a long sort of written statement. And they pointed to, you know, they have put in a lot of new programs over the last 10 years. They've changed the way that they do business. You know, Michigan before didn't even have a centralized hotline where abuse and neglect was reported. And so now they've got that sort of like a statewide dispatch center that screens these calls and sends them out for investigation. You know, they've created a special team that investigates allegations of abuse or neglect within the foster care system. So they pointed to a lot of these programs that they've put in place, and there are a number of statistics that have moved in the right direction. They are, you know, the number of kids in foster care is going down. They have accomplished some goals in terms of the timeliness of finding safe permanent homes. So, you know, they really pointed on that, but they didn't address some of the bigger issues about why these deaths are going up. Why the mistakes are still happening like they are.
So have you talked to lawmakers? Have you talked to anyone in any kind of position to look further into this, to try to sort things out, to try to fix whatever, you know, these mistakes that keep happening are going on? You know, someone outside of DHHS?
Well, certainly Judge Nancy Edmonds in the federal court has seen my stories. And there are, you know, as part of this, one of the things, and the workers talk about being more focused on sort of metrics over mission. I did a series of stories last year where there were allegations in seven counties that supervisors were essentially assigning cases to employees who were on medical leave or out of the office for other reasons. And that sort of makes the caseloads appear more evenly distributed than they really are. And that's being investigated right now in the legislature by the Michigan Auditor General. The federal court has asked that the court-appointed monitors look into that. So all of those things are happening. You know, and certainly children's rights is seeing a lot of the same statistics that I'm seeing and are, you know, arguing that as the federal lawsuit goes on.
Justin Hinckley is the Lansing State Journal's government reporter, taking a look at the number of Michigan kids in foster care who are dying from abuse or neglect. He joined us from LSJ's newsroom. Justin, thank you so much.
Thank you for your time.
Let's turn now to our regular guests, Ken Sikkema and Vicki Barnett, for a look at this past week's politics. Ken is Senior Policy Fellow with Public Sector Consultants, and he's former Republican Majority Leader in the State Senate. And Vicki is a former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator. So, Ken, we've got these dueling challenges from two Democratic candidates for governor. Both Sri Tanadar and Abdul El-Sayed are each questioning each other's eligibility for the office. What is going on here?
Well, these kind of disputes are pretty typical, I think, of late. And, you know, I'm a Republican, but the Republican primary for governor has been nasty for some time. So I'm not sure I'm the one who ought to be pointing fingers here. But I think, you know, both of them probably think the other one takes votes from them if they're on the ballot. And, you know, bottom line is the other candidate, Senator Whitmer, former Senator Whitmer, is probably just sitting back enjoying all of it.
Right. She's sitting back just, you know, eating some popcorn, watching this,
I don't make too much of these disputes at this point, because I think early August, when you have the primary, people are going to be making their judgment based on other things. They're not going to be making their judgment, at least I don't think, on these kind of arguments or accusations. I just think they'll be making it on other things.
Right. That's true that there's sort of the politics of it all. But Vicki, there is an actual legal question that has not been answered yet in the case of El-Sayed's eligibility for governor. This legal question of whether he is a quote unquote qualified elector.
There could be a concern, but El-Sayed has been registered to vote in Michigan for years. He's lived in Michigan for years. He was born and raised here. He's certainly a Michigander in all aspects of the word. He went to New York for a few years, like most young people do when they leave college. They go somewhere else for a little while and then come back. I don't think that that should disqualify him from the ballot, although I am not an attorney. I am not an attorney with election law, so I don't know if he never terminated his registration in Michigan. I'm more concerned about the tenor and the tone of the discourse between the candidates than I am about some of these critical questions, which I understand the concern that if he's knocked off the ballot and he wins the primary, what do Democrats do for a candidate? But I think that you're right that Senator Gretchen Whitmer is sitting back and watching this play out. I don't think she's eating popcorn. I think she's concerned because this doesn't look good for the party.
I was going to say, I mean, is this not particularly what Democrats need right now, as many feel like they are, you know, riding high going into election 2018? We saw this sort of boil down to a similar fight or another fight at the Democratic convention between, you know, progressives and quote unquote the establishment.
I think there is a great concern that we need to bring all elements of the party together. And that's what many of us have been working toward. There's no need to break out into factions. We're all on the same team, and we need to work toward the same goal. So that's my concern. And these battles about knocking somebody off the ballot because they don't have the signatures, let the Secretary of State's office do their due diligence and count the signatures and make sure they're all valid.
And Ken, I, as a Republican, I think you've probably seen this movie before, right, between the Tea Party wing of the party and, again, the sort of quote-unquote establishment.
Well, yes. But going back to this particular issue of whether this Democratic candidate should be on the ballot or not, and I'm not a lawyer and I don't know about all the legal issues at stake, but historically and traditionally, the courts have been very reluctant to kind of insert themselves and remove people from the ballot. They tend to allow the election process to play out. And I'm just going to make a guess here, probably shouldn't, but I think this person stays on the ballot unless there's some extremely egregious violation of Michigan election law. Now, the larger issue I think you started talking about, and Vicki started talking about, is that, you know, the parties are very, very polarized. And it just seems to me that kind of the most alienated and frustrated voters on both sides have become extremely influential in party primary battles. And the difficulty for both sides then is how do you change direction for the general election when you have to attract more independent voters and some voters from the other side? I think that's a real problem shaping up in this election year, not just in Michigan, but across the country, really for both parties.
Okay, so let's take that narrative then and move over to the Republican Party. We had President Donald Trump in Washington Township, Michigan, over the weekend holding a rally. He gave a shout out to Michigan Attorney General Bill Schuette. Bill Schuette is in this race against Brian Kelly, the current lieutenant governor. And we're seeing some strains also within these two candidates for governor, right, Ken?
Yes. Yes, very much so. Here's the challenge for Republicans is Trump has extremely high favorability ratings among conservative Republican primary voters. And so in the case of Bill Schuette, he's totally embraced Trump. Trump's embraced Bill Schuette. Bill Schuette understands that, and it's extremely helpful to him, I think, in a primary, Republican primary. But what happens the day after the primary should he be successful? How do you then change direction and attract voters that don't look at Trump very favorably? I mean, the special elections around the country in the last several months have all pointed toward a anti-Trump Democratic wave, if you will. So how does a Bill Schuette, if he's successful, deal with that after the primary?
Vicki, as a Democrat, then looking at that, right, that Schuette, and I've been saying he's not even doubling down on Trump support, it's now like quadrupling down. I mean, is Schuette then, are you thinking in 2018, if there is this blue wave, sort of the candidate you would want your Democratic gubernatorial candidate to run against because he is so tied with Donald Trump, who overall is unpopular, again, not within the Republican Party, but overall, which is, you know, the general election?
Yes. Of course, you know, we want the weakest candidate that comes out of the Republican Party to run against. But don't forget, be careful what you wish for, because that weak candidate could end up winning. I mean, we have a President Trump that nobody ever expected would win the presidency. So one has to be, again, careful for what they wish for. I think that Ken is right, and what happens during a primary is all of these candidates right now are trying to attract either, if you're a Republican, the most conservative voters to vote for you in the primary, or if you're a Democrat, the most progressive voters to vote for you in the primary. And that's where the battle lines are being drawn, and that's why these candidates are going after each other so viscerally. The problem comes with the 40% or so voters that don't consider themselves conservative Republicans or liberal Democrats and consider themselves either middle of the roaders in the Republican or Democratic Party or independents. And how are you going to fight for them when a poll just showed that Donald Trump is highly unpopular with that group of voters? And transitioning from a very far right or far left position into the center has always been a challenge for candidates and will be more so after the bifurcation of parties during these primary elections.
Vicki Barnett is a former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator. And Ken Sikkema is a senior policy fellow with Public Sector Consultants, as well as a former Republican majority leader in the state Senate. Ken joined us by Skype. Hey, you two, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Zoe.
And if that is not enough politics for you, I know it's not enough for me. Why don't you come to Washington, D.C. with me? Zoe Clark, Michigan Radio. We are planning a trip to the nation's capital in October. You can find the details at the website michiganradio.org. We're going to have a couple of introductory events in 2 weeks. Hope to see you there. We'll be right back. that's the show today. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I am Zoe Clark, sitting in today for Lester Graham. Thanks so much for listening.